More than 2 million people in Illinois are on SNAP benefits, commonly known as food stamps. And when the state started providing those later in the month, shoplifting in Chicago grocery stores fell by nearly a third.
Something as easy as just spreading out when benefits are distributed can have such a big impact.
Also, staffers from President Obama's administration are planning to run for office on their own and in some cases even competing against each other. Politico's Elena Schneider explains what's behind all these political campaigns. Plus, Chicago writer Marcus Saeki's latest novel, Afterlife, is a thriller and a love story about what happens after we die.
I don't want to give away spoilers, but it's sort of nested like Russian dolls, with life as the center of things and various stages that come after that aren't at all what the protagonist expected.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 7 years ago, Illinois changed the date of the month when SNAP benefits, commonly known as food stamps, get dispersed. That tiny change had a major ripple effect, especially in Chicago. A recent study by two economists found that simply spreading out when people got their SNAP benefits helped reduce shoplifting in Chicago grocery stores by 30%. I'm joined now by one of the co-authors of that study. Annalisa Packham is an assistant professor of economics at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Also joining us on the line from Eastern Illinois University is Michael Gillespie, an assistant professor of sociology. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having us.
Annalisa, let's start with this study and what you all found. We briefly mentioned it as I was introducing the conversation. Let's start with what are some of the big takeaways about SNAP benefits that you want people to know about?
So I think that you did a great job introducing this topic, but specifically the big takeaway here is that by distributing SNAP benefits later in the month or not on the first of the month, then we can have some pretty dramatic decreases in theft and crime at grocery stores.
Originally, is the idea that benefits get dispersed around the same time people get their paychecks? Is that the difference of changing it for the timing of the month?
That's definitely part of it. So social scientists kind of refer to this idea of consumption smoothing, or that budgeting, you budget to spend the same amount of money each week. And so we know that people aren't very good at consumption smoothing. And specifically, we can imagine that many SNAP recipients are receiving other cash transfers or welfare benefits or paychecks from their jobs on the first of the month. And so then distributing nutritional assistance on, say, the 21st of the month can help families avoid resource scarcity at the end of the month because they can now go buy food at the end of the month when they start running out of cash.
And Michael, remind us, SNAP is literally stands for a Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. That means then that it's intended to be a supplemental program, not so it is important to think about the fact that people are supposed to have other sources of income around this benefit, correct?
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, it's a supplement to the assets that a family can bring to the quote-unquote table, if you will, in terms of providing their own access to food and other resources.
And Annalisa, when we think about these benefits, I know they range greatly, but can you give us a sense of what the average SNAP benefit is for an average-sized family? How does that work?
Sure. So the benefits are based on family size. But over 45 million American individuals are receiving SNAP each year. So like you mentioned, it will vary. The average is less than $200 a month. And it's important to remember that this is strictly an in-kind transfer. So the $200 can't be redeemed for cash. It can strictly go towards food purchases.
And I think the headline here about the crime is something that might catch a lot of people's attention. What do you think the link is here? What did you find from your research?
So we look at a lot of different links here. Maybe something else could be driving this change. But really, I think the story is that by giving SNAP benefits later in the month, it's helping families avoid this resource scarcity at the end of the month when they start running out of cash or other benefits. And so we know that about half of all SNAP recipients exhaust all of their benefits within the first 2 weeks of receipt. So just by simply giving it to them later in the month, it helps them kind of juggle all of these other income sources that they're receiving to help them, say, budget throughout the entire month.
I'm speaking with one of the co-authors of this study we've been talking about. Annalisa Packham is an assistant professor of economics at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and also joining us, professor of sociology at Eastern Illinois University, Michael Gillespie. Michael, can I ask you, as you're thinking about this, as we're talking about particularly the Annalisa's study found, what does this tell you about the ways that policymakers could possibly make it easier for people with lower incomes to afford the food they need to feed their families?
Yeah, I think what it says to me is oftentimes to come up with solutions to big problems, and definitely food insecurity, resource scarcity is a big problem, but oftentimes we kind of complicate the issue more by trying to come up with some really big policy proposals or programs to fix these conditions, when something as easy as just spreading out when benefits are distributed is something that is so small but so easy can have such a big impact. And we spend a lot of time thinking about big issues needing big resolution or big fixes, but sometimes it's the smallest things that have the most impact for the lives of the people who get these benefits.
Annalisa, is it as simple as that? Is that that it could be? Is it easy to change the distribution, the date of distribution? Is that a difficult thing for? And is that something that happens from the federal government, or is it something that happens at the state level?
So all SNAP distribution policies are at the state level. Even though it's a federally funded program, states have a great amount of autonomy in how much they distribute and when they distribute it. So there are still 7 states that distribute all benefits on the first of the month. We could certainly think of it as being a relatively costless intervention to increase the number of distribution dates in those states, just because SNAP benefits are distributed electronically on a debit-like card. So changing the issuance dates might have, say, 1 month of transition, but it should be relatively costless for other states to interact these programs. And I want to highlight here that when we say that states are changing the number of days that they distribute SNAP benefits, that it doesn't mean that individuals are now receiving benefits multiple times in a month. It simply just makes their benefits available later in the month. So another potential policy intervention is then to have some states maybe eventually try to distribute SNAP benefits to one individual twice a month instead of all on that one day.
Interesting. And just again, how did you make sure there was a causal link between SNAP benefits and crime, and it wasn't sort of a classic case? I think people always think that correlation equals causation, right?
Right. So essentially what we do is we just say, on February 16th, 2010, when that policy changed, do we see a sharp change in the number of crime? And we do see it right away. And so the other question is, okay, well, for this to be causal, we would then need to say, are there any other potential explanations or other policy changes that coincide with the SNAP policy change? So we look at whether changes in weather on that date, or labor force participation, or SNAP issuance falling on a weekend or a payday, if any of these other things could potentially explain this huge drop in crime, we find that the only thing that we can find to explain it is the change in the issuance date.
So what did you find in terms of the part of your research also looked at who is committing these crimes? What did you find?
Yeah, so we look at, in another part of our paper, some data from Indiana, and we actually find that the individuals committing these crimes tend to be older individuals, they tend to be white, and they tend to be females. So this is really important going forward in introducing the narrative of who is stealing food at grocery stores, because we think that it might actually be either moms or individuals that have families that simply can't make their benefits last throughout the entire month.
Michael, as we think of all of this, do you think there's still quite a bit of stigma associated with people who receive SNAP benefits? And I wonder if you could speak to that, as well as the demographics of what that looks like, particularly in Illinois, the types of folks that are receiving SNAP benefits.
Well, I think historically, just not with SNAP, but people who are poor in general tend to be stigmatized. there's different stigmas around, you know, you think about, for example, there's this myth of the welfare mom who is a single mom, usually of non-white racial background, who has multiple children and continues to have them just to draw down benefits. But that has been proven time and time again to be a myth. We often think about people who pull down government benefits as sort of being kind of listless and lazy and not have any connections. But there's a large majority of SNAP beneficiaries are working people, either part-time or full-time. They're families. Oftentimes they're married. And so they're productive members of society. And that counts, you know, for Illinois and all over the country. But we have this myth of people going out and asking for assistance and needing help is sort of doing something wrong or not playing the game or not being able to participate in their in society the way that we generally think normal, quote unquote, people should. And so seeing these studies like this, like Annalisa's study and how the there's these broad ranging connections made between simple ways to help people out and major social problems. I think it's an important connection that we can look at that can actually counteract some of the stigma.
Michael, in fact, to your point, I just wanted to ask you about some action that's happened recently. Governor Rauner recently issued a mandatory veto on a bill that would have made 40,000 college students eligible for food stamps. Certainly, food insecurity and food problems is something that is we've known in the past couple of years is becoming an increasing problem on college campuses. Governor Rauner's veto changed the part of the bill that would require the states to notify these students and tell them they're eligible. Michael, I'm wondering your thoughts on Governor Rauner's actions recently.
Well, I think this is a good, clear example of doing little things that can have a huge impact. And the portion of the bill that was vetoed as the amendatory veto was simply a provision to notify students that they're eligible for the benefits. And these are vocational students. These are community college students who are in vocational technology programs. Oftentimes they're non-traditional students, maybe going back to school a second time to get a new trade, have families in and of themselves. And the governor was supportive of this bill all the way through. It had wide-ranging bipartisan support, and the only part of it that he changed with the veto was just making sure that the individuals and the families who were college students were eligible for food stamps, just making it known to them that they could apply and get them. And so, again, it's one of those examples of just doing something so small that can have such a huge impact here now, detrimental to those families and those recipients, rather than getting them the access to the resources that they need.
Annalisa, as Michael's talking about that, how important are things, as Michael's saying, these small things like notifying someone they're eligible? How much do you think, how important is that to recipients of the program?
That's a good question. I don't really have a measure of how much that deters or encourages someone, but we know that generally information or access to information about eligibility encourages participation. So SNAP take-up rates are not as high as they could be. They're certainly not anywhere close to 100%. So by making individuals who are eligible aware of the program and aware of the fact that they can sign up for it with maybe even just a low-cost application to them, then of course that can have huge impacts on who participates in the program and how many people were able to help get out of food insecurity.
Annalisa, for you, as we've had this conversation about, I think people often think of the problem as hunger as something that's very wide-ranging and difficult to solve. There's a lot of passion and emotion around government benefits for this. How do you want people to think about this issue?
So I think that there's basically kind of three answers to that. The first being that, as Michael touched on, the folks that we think of as being food insecure are often going days or several meals without anything to eat are not kind of the typical stereotypes that we think of being promoted to us as we are growing up. Oftentimes these are working families and they just simply don't have enough to go around. and they're not trying to, say, leech off of the system to the detriment of taxpayers. They often need these benefits to feed their kids, to have their kids do well in school, and to simply have that ability to contribute more to the economy. The second thing I just want to hit home here is that if we know that several SNAP recipients aren't able to make their benefits last to the end of the month and have to resort to, say, theft at grocery stores to fill the empty pantry shelves at home, then one potential move going forward is to think about increasing the amount of SNAP benefits that recipients are getting each month, or simply giving those benefits to individuals twice a month.
Thanks for joining us. That's Annalisa Packham, one of the co-authors of the study we've been talking about. She's at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. I want to thank Michael Gillespie as well with Eastern Illinois University. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
As a reminder, we love hearing feedback from you. You can always get in touch with us. Leave us a voicemail. Send us an email. All of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. That's where you can leave us a voicemail. Send us an email. Give us feedback. We'd love to hear from you. If you follow us on Facebook, search for the 21st to like us. You can also post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. And if you follow our Twitter handle, that's our Twitter handle is 21stshow. That's 21st show. During the program, we live tweet with more background and context analysis on what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Our handle is 21st Show. Stay tuned. The 21st continues after this short break. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Afterlife is the newest novel from Chicago writer Marcus Saeki. He's a prolific writer whose most recent work includes the Brilliance Trilogy. That's a science fiction action world where 1% of the population has genetically mutated abilities. In Afterlife, we have an entirely new world that reimagines what happened after we die. It's a fast-paced thriller, and it's a love story. It's set in Chicago, and it's already being turned into a film from Imagine Entertainment. That's Ron Howard and Brian Grazer's production company. He's writing the screenplay for that, too, by the way. This book is just out. It's a hit number one on Amazon. Marcus is here in studio with me now in downtown Chicago. Hey, Marcus, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
So the idea from this book came from a dream, or maybe you would describe it more of as a nightmare?
It wasn't a nightmare at first. At first, it was just a dream. I was in downtown Chicago in the dream, and it was empty. It was abandoned. And in that dream way, I knew that it was abandoned because I was dead. Everyone else actually was there. I was the one who was set aside. But it wasn't scary in itself. It wasn't a frightening dream. It was just kind of an interesting one until I woke up. And I was laying in bed with my wife, you know, my partner of 20 years, and I was imagining being in the same city as her, the same place, the same room, and not being able to interact with her at all.
Wow.
And at that point, it became a nightmare.
Yeah. Right.
And that it came with the kind of juice where it's like, well, I have to do something with that.
When was that?
The initial seize of that was a couple of years ago. It's been kicking around in various forms.
Okay.
This one was a tough book for me to write.
Well, a tough book for you to write, and I want to get into that, but let's just talk about the story, because it's kind of crazy, and I mean that in the best way possible.
Excellent. Crazy we like.
It's so different from your other work, like The Brilliant Saga, and I think it was the second chapter where I just had to stop, and there's no spoilers here, but the main character, Will Brody, dies, and I just thought, what is happening? Marcus just killed off his main character, and then it just goes somewhere where I entirely did not think it was going to go.
Good.
There's a lot of layers to this story, and I mean that literally in the book as well as metaphorically. I mean that in a lot of ways. So how hard was this to write? Because you're writing the story about a world and then other worlds, and there's still like the heart of this plot is a mystery, but then there's also a love story.
It's a lot of elements at once. I sort of decided that on this, I'd rather just leave it all on the field than feel like I held back at all. But more than anything, it's a love story to me. It's a love story about two people who won't let even death get between them. And I got to invent the afterlife, which I highly recommend. It's a great exercise for an afternoon, is inventing your own afterlife. And in my version, it's sort of... I don't want to give away spoilers, but it's sort of nested like Russian dolls, with life as the center of things and various stages that come after that aren't at all what the protagonists expected.
So there are ghosts, there are vampires in this in this afterlife that you like. Vampire isn't the right word.
It's not. There are,
like, I guess we maybe call them. They're like energetic vampires or spiritual vampires. Like, they're not like actual.
Oh, that sounds like such a mishmash. That sounds awful. I would never read a book with energetic vampires.
No, I mean like around energy as opposed to drinking blood. Yeah. Where did, I guess before we get into the world that you created, when I was reading this, I was thinking, when Marcus was a kid, like, what did he learn about hell?
How messed up was this man?
No, I'm just curious about that.
To me, what I wanted to do was create a vision of an afterlife that, well, not scientific at all, it was sort of in the neighborhood of something you could buy as science, and sort of an altered reality, with the idea being that the energy that we have that is life, that is the power to create and fall in love and write poetry, that energy doesn't just vanish. It kind of fades away in these increasing steps. And then because I write thrillers and there have to be knife fights and, violence, that energy can also be taken from you in these afterworlds. And so there are people there who were normal people and found themselves in this space and decided that they would rather do whatever they wanted to for power and life and sensation.
And so there's a really interesting concept in your book that was fascinating to me, which is that those people who want to sort of take the bad energy then kind of feed off that in the world. So when we have events like terrorist events where everybody's afraid or, I'm just thinking of the state that we're in right now in our country where we've had a lot of things that have made people very angry or very nervous. In your book, that's something that, like, people are not entities are actually feeding off of. Is that
and creating.
And they're responsible for creating it, too. Yeah. Where did that come from, that whole idea of yours?
Well, that came from wanting answers for how some of these things are happening. And I've always been fascinated by mythology. Myths were our way to try and put an answer to something, even if you didn't believe it. I mean, the great thing about myths is they can be true without being real. They can have kind of an inner truth. And what I wanted to do was come up with an answer for why some of the craziest of the things in our world happen, the things that they just didn't seem to before. Maybe that was just a matter of culture and reporting, but it didn't seem to be common, used to be common for people to walk into a movie theater with an automatic weapon, or just these, the more horrifying examples of bad human behavior. And so for me, it was interesting to imagine that that they were being influenced by worlds beyond what we could see.
And so there's a passage that you have that I wanted to read where you say, perhaps the truth is that hell wasn't a physical location. Hell had been created countless times before. It was almost an equation to it. Hell was born when some decided others weren't people.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's also a really interesting and very strong sense of morality throughout all of this also about the way that we treat people and the consequences that has, regardless of whether they're living or dead.
That's central to me. I mean, for all of this, in a lot of ways, it's a very simple parable if you pare down some of the elaborations. It's you can roll over other people and take from them, and you can benefit doing that, but you become something less than human. And Within the book, I compare that to the uber wealthy who, you know, just take and take and take and don't care. And that extended into my afterlife is it's really the same sort of action.
And so how did you prepare for this? Because in your past books, you've done super cool things like be with SWAT teams. And like, how do you prepare for writing a book about the afterlife in Chicago? Because I love the scenes of walking around Chicago being abandoned. And this is a city that's not often abandoned. So did you walk around the Loop like on a Saturday afternoon? Or how did you figure out how to do this?
This one was more than anything an intellectual exercise. A lot of the research I've done, like hanging out with SWAT teams and diving for pirate treasure and stuff, that's so I can get the physical details right. This one, I spent a year wandering around just kind of imagining wherever I was, whatever I was doing at that moment, what might it look like in the Echo, in my afterlife. It got to be kind of a bad habit. I'd be like out for date night with my wife, and I'd be sitting in a restaurant, I'd be looking around, I'd be like, well, it'd be really dark in here because there's no lights, there'd probably be no one in here. And I'd realize I'd completely neglected my end of the conversation.
Because you were imagining it.
Yeah, and then my wife would look over, she'd be like, you're thinking about the dead people again, aren't you?
Yeah. It's like a bad version of Ghost.
I'm thinking about the dead people.
So that said, I do think it's an interesting thing that this is genre busting is a terrible word, but what kind of, I wonder if this book would have been, I wonder, first of all, how do you describe this? Because you've done there's science fiction, and I wonder how hard it is for publishers if they feel like you're not in a specific category.
Yeah, it's a frustrating notion, genre as it relates to sales. I mean, for me, as a lifelong reader, there's two kinds of writing. You know, there's good and bad, and the goal is to just put everything you can into being on the good side of the equation. But genre is really, it's a sales tool, right? It's to tell you which aisles in the bookstore you don't want to walk down. It's not even the ones you do, really. It's the ones you don't. It's like, I don't go to the self-help aisle. I'm not that interested overall in the romance aisle. But the others are ones that I do go to. I don't know. To me, there is some frustration in crossing genre lines, but I think there's also enormous power in it. You know, I didn't set out to do a mashup. I set up to write the truest version that I could. And I think it's mostly being classified as a thriller, which is where I'd put it.
Well, and I also wonder, this probably, as a first-time author couldn't have probably, I wonder if a first-time author could have written something like this and gotten it published. Because it's kind of, but I feel like you're so prolific. You have a great following of people who enjoy your work already. Do you think it's easier to write something like this that's kind of genre busting if you're already an established author?
Possibly. I mean, I know I couldn't have written this as a first novel. This was my ninth and it nearly killed me. I rewrote the first 100 pages 9 times. I just, there was so much balance and coordination that I wanted in it. That for me, I needed to, have 8 novels under my belt before I could attack it. I don't know. I guess I'm just a big believer in readers. I think readers will always respond to a good story forcefully told. And I think focusing on anything else is a little silly.
So Will and Claire are your central characters here. We touched on this in the beginning, that this really is a love story between the two of them. Why was it so important for you that that's such a strong thread throughout this all? That's really what ties this whole book together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. I mean, it goes back to the dream that gave birth to it. Was what made that potent was the idea of not being able to connect with the woman that I love. And that's a very human and I think very universal fear and thought about death. Another thing that I wanted to do is we have this idea that when we die, we'll get all the answers, right? Either if you're a religious person, you'll land according to the tenets of your religion. If you're not, it'll be blackness, and that's an answer too. To me, it was fascinating to imagine, like, no, what if you died and you found yourself somewhere and you still didn't have any answers? And so you had to decide who you were going to be based on your your morals and your internal compass, and love plates back into that rather importantly. Is, you know, if you can love, if you can be with another person, then you're probably going to choose to be the right kind of person even there.
Are you a religious person? Have people been asking you this since you've written this? Uh-oh.
Yeah, no, I am not. I guess I'd fall into the more things in heaven and earth Horatio category, but no, I'm not.
I imagine you've probably been getting that question a lot. I want to go back to, I'm speaking with Marcus Seki, by the way. His latest book that's just out is called Afterlife. We've been talking about the novel. We've been talking about your readers. But you're also writing the screenplay for this.
Yeah.
How crazy is that? Is it
fairly
very
crazy.
Different?
Yeah.
Also?
Yeah. I spent a lot of time as a screenwriter hating the novelist.
It's thinking, why did this guy do this?
Why
really?
Did this guy do this to me? It's really enormous fun. I mean, it's kind of having a whole new set of colors on my palette.
What? But is it hard because when you're writing a screenplay, you have to put all of this into reality? Or is it hard? What's the hard thing about writing the screenplay, making this into a movie and writing this as a screenplay versus the book?
The hardest thing, and the reason most people will tell you the book is better than the movie in any case, is that the book's 300 or 400 pages long and the screenplay is 110, you know, with a lot of white space. You have to cut a lot, and you have to merge things, and you have to kind of wash it down to the essential truths of the story. And in the times where that's really well done, the movie still works great as a separate entity from the book. In the times where it's badly done and you make something up whole cloth or it just goes in a different direction, it's really frustrating too.
It must be really painful for you too, right? As the person who wrote the novel to then be the person who's going through and saying, we're got to cut this?
Yeah.
Is that really hard?
It is hard. I mean, there's a good bit of writing wisdom that is just in general is kill your darlings. In other words, don't get so attached to a
sure.
paragraph.
Journalists
or
say
page.
That all the time.
Kill your darlings.
Well, the journalists say kill the baby, but kill your darling sounds a lot better.
Well, the thing is, I mean, to write a novel, I've already got a bathtub full of drowned darlings. I mean, I've already killed a lot of darlings. So these were the ones that survived, and now they're back in the Hunger Games.
Wow.
It is hard, but honestly, it's also, I'm so grateful to have the opportunity. I'm really enjoying the process.
And did it surprise you? Were there things you realized that weren't as important as you thought they were in the book now that you're doing the screenplay?
What surprises me is realizing, even after all the time I spent on this book, that there are different ways to tell this story. You know, as you get into a book, you start to make decisions. You have to make decisions. If it's all options, it's all theory. So you start making decisions, and then those decisions become kind of the facts of the book for you. This is a fresh look at it, to just look at it again and be like, does it have to be that way? Can I tell the same story and lose this part and still have the same emotional resonance? Or can I change this character's motivation? It's been interesting to come back at it that way. And there's an upside too that I'm really excited about, is the kind of collaborative nature of this, is the idea that I can write this, and if I do it well, a first-rate actor or actress is going to be speaking these lines and putting it on their face and carrying the weight of a scene. I mean, that's pretty big help.
So I don't know what the time frame for this is, where obviously casting hasn't happened yet.
No.
Can I ask you who would you want to play Will and Claire in this? Do you have a dream?
Sure.
Who are your actors you have picked out who you'd love to have do this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll be clear that neither of them even knows this exists, but if Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt wanted to show up, they would be more than welcome in my version of the movie.
All right. I'm speaking with Marcus Seki. He's the author of Afterlife, soon to be a major motion picture.
Yeah, from Ron Howard.
All right, from Ron Howard. The book is out now. Marcus, thanks so much for being here with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Since taking over the White House in November, the Trump administration has made repeated attempts to reverse key regulations implemented during Barack Obama's presidency. Now, in efforts to stand up for that legacy, roughly a dozen or so of his past staffers are moving home to California, Texas, and other states to make campaign runs of their own, not just in Congress, but in state assemblies. Elena Schneider covered the up-and-coming Obama alums for Politico, where she focuses on House and Senate races. She's on the line with us now from Washington to talk about the piece that she did recently. Elena, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Elena, one of the things that I thought was so interesting about your story was this wasn't something that former Obama staffers necessarily intended to do after they left office. How much of these decisions were made very recently and because of the Trump administration particularly?
I think nearly all of them were made in the days and weeks after the presidential election results in November. I don't think any of these staffers, much like the rest of the country, expected the results to be that it was. And I think some were even planning or expecting for roles in the Clinton administration. So not only do you have them witnessing President Trump rolling back much of the legacy that they were a part of implementing under the Obama administration, but they also have the very real situation of having to move home because there are not as many jobs in Washington for them at the moment. So I think it's both witnessing and feeling this call to action that Obama sort of left them with, but then also simply being in the right time and place in their own lives to make a real run for Congress.
Can you tell us about some of these people? In some cases, there are actually some alums that are running against each other.
That's correct. We've got a pretty contested Democratic primary down in Texas to take on Pete Sessions. And Pete Sessions, it's interesting, he's a Republican congressman who didn't even draw a Democratic challenger last year. He ran unopposed. So, and yet we've already got several candidates who are trying to take him on. We've got two down there, though, who are former Obama alums. This guy, Ed Meyer, who used to work in the State Department. And then Colin Allred, who was a White House intern right after law school, but then also went on to work for Julian Castro at the Housing and Urban Development Department. And these are two candidates who are both relying on their Obama resume as a key line item to sort of say to people, look, this is my political training, this is my ethos, where I come from, and this is part of the reason why you should back me. But then also they're both tapping into it as a source for fundraising, which for first-time candidates, which both Ed and Colin are, is a really important element of being able to distinguish yourself in a primary. And both of them have been able to rely on those Obama networks to raise money.
It's interesting you say that, because here in Illinois, I think there's so many people who worked in the former administration, who worked with President Obama, or who were legislators with him alongside the time that he spent in the State House here. I wonder, for the folks who are coming from Washington and for people who are coming from outside of Illinois and other states, what other advantages they have against, say, maybe an up-and-coming politician who hasn't been tied to a previous administration.
Well, I think they're all going to try variations on being an outsider, even though obviously they have some insider experience having worked in a presidential administration. They can sort of position themselves as someone who hasn't been an elected official themselves. And that continues to prove to be a potent attack line on incumbents and on people that you're challenging. It doesn't always work, especially if people like their congressman, but if it's someone who's caught a little flat-footed or hasn't been tending to sort of the home fires, that can be a really effective way to break through both a primary and a general election. And I think we can expect all of these Obama alumni who are running to sort of use some variation of that as they run here.
And when we're looking at the DCCC and the DNC and how they're sort of trying to organize and fundraise coming up next year. How many of them are putting money behind Obama alums versus other Democratic candidates?
Well, Democrats are in a really interesting position this cycle in that they have candidates basically falling from the trees at this point. There are people who are just coming out of nowhere to run for Congress because they feel activated by this political moment. And Trump has continued to have that effect on candidates to make them feel like this is the moment where they want to get involved. So that means that we're going to have all kinds of crowded House and Assembly, you know, up and down the ballot, but in particular House races in which you've got not only one candidate or one viable candidate, but maybe three, four, five. There's a race here in Northern Virginia with another Obama alum where there's, I believe, nine candidates who are trying to run to challenge this Republican Congresswoman, Barbara Comstock. So the DCCC, as you say, is in a sort of difficult position in that they generally take the position that they don't get involved in primaries, but they reserve the right to, and that they will occasionally step in, but by and large, they try and stay out of these situations because they want the voters and the primary voters to not feel like Washington is coming in sort of picking their candidate for them. But occasionally they do step in if they feel like there's a particular candidate who is better suited for the district, who they feel like is going to be the right person. But so far, those maneuverings haven't started to take place. That'll happen usually in the early months of 2018.
And Alina, you wrote about an Obama Alumni Association. Is that an actual group?
It is. It's a sort of informal group. All kinds of these sort of informal, organic networks sprang out of the Obama alumni who left the administration. And, you know, it's important to remember, too, this was the first social media presidency. This was the first social media campaign. So these are all relatively young people who are savvy, who want to stay connected with each other, who are spread out across the country. And so they were quick to come up with solutions to stay in touch with each other. So the Obama Alumni Association is maybe the most formalized organization that sprung out of that, but they all use these sort of informal networks, email listservs to stay in touch with
each other.
Secret
Facebook groups, probably. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Facebook groups, too, where they're able to stay in touch with each other and talk about candidates, talk about issues that they care about, and that's how a lot of these candidates have been able to sort of crowdsource some of their political advice and help. And I was speaking with Andy Kim, a Democrat Obama official who works for the National Security Council, who's running in New Jersey. And he asked several of his friends from the Obama administration to help him film his announcement video. So I think that they're all using these organic networks not only to fundraise but to simply sort of help them get off the ground.
Alina, do you think any? I know it's very early, but do you think any of these alums have realistic shots at winning their races? Certainly, it sounds like from everything you've said, they've got a lot of experience and networks to draw on that may help prove to their advantage.
Well, they've got two hurdles to get through. They've both got to get through a primary, which for a lot of them are competitive, and they're not the only ones in it who are both putting up good money and who have good resumes. So they've first got to get through a primary, and then second, they've got to get through a general election. And as you say, it's really early. It's hard to tell as of now, but I think that given that we've got a dozen and maybe more getting into these races, it seems likely that just simply by the numbers here that there might be one or two who head to Congress. I mean, the other interesting point is just that Obama got a lot of criticism for not actually paying attention to down ballot races and basically kind of letting those races out to dry, that there wasn't actually a lot of party building that happened beneath him when he was president. And so that, you know, we saw these huge sweeps in 2010 through 2014 of all these down ballot state ledge races in which that all turned red. And it's sort of an interesting contrast where we've got these people who are trying to, his legacy, even as they, you know, are also contending with the fact that there's plenty of Democrats who criticize Obama for not actually tending sort of to the home team.
So more people who are trying to further the legacy and work of President Barack Obama. That's Alina Schneider. She focuses on House and Senate races for Politico. We'll tweet out the story she wrote about all these Obama alums all over the country. Alina, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. We live in an age where you can search the internet to find reviews about pretty much anything. Restaurants, vacation spots, home services, the latest technology. But like those reviews, when it comes to finding out reviews about healthcare providers, there aren't very many trustworthy places to turn to online. A Springfield doctor is working to change that. Dr. Ish Singla is an interventional cardiologist and the founder of HealthSoul.com. He's on the line now to tell us more about this site. Dr. Singla, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla. Thank you for the introduction.
So you're the co-creator to HealthSoul.com along with your wife. What's the idea behind it?
So me and my wife founded HealthSoul in 2016. My wife had a high-risk pregnancy, and we were looking for consumer reviews on hospitals and doctors for pregnancy. We found very little information, so we decided to create a web portal to help patients and healthcare consumers to mitigate those challenges.
Yeah, I think a lot of times the reason why there aren't as many review sites, or there are review sites, right, when you try to find a doctor, it says, like, this person, there's, like, health grades or whatever, and it gives this doctor 5 stars, and you have no idea who gave these people 5 stars. I know there's been an argument also about HIPAA violations from healthcare providers, that the reason there isn't, like, for example, a Yelp for healthcare is that doctors necessarily can't defend themselves because of HIPAA and privacy laws. How do you guys handle that with HealthSoul.com?
So our website provides consumers and patients to provide review on doctors, hospitals, and health insurance on different domains. And when different domains are reviewed, it makes the website more trustworthy and more useful for other consumers when they're looking for healthcare provider ratings. Healthcare providers can respond to these reviews, but these reviews can be responded only in HIPAA-compliant way, which means that no patient information can be placed on the portal. It will be removed by our website managers. And hospitals can say, thank you for writing a great review, or they can say, we are sorry to hear that you didn't have a good experience, so please contact us at a hospital-specific email so that the information is HIPAA-compliant.
I see. So it's okay for HIPAA rules for doctors to acknowledge that this is someone who is their patient?
Patients have acknowledged first that they are their doctors, because they're writing the review.
Right. So you think, so if a patient's already self-disclosed that, it's okay for a doctor to acknowledge it?
They have self-disclosed, yes.
I see. Okay. And what's been your experience so far with healthcare providers? Have you found that this is something that other colleagues of yours who are other doctors or other hospitals say they would like to have?
So we are approaching different hospitals and clinics to give them a trial to see if they would like this portal. We are still in process of signing up the practices or the hospitals for this portal. We feel that this portal will have a great use for not only for patients, but also for doctors and hospitals for their increase their online presence and attract more patients.
This is still in the very early stages of what you're creating, correct?
Yes.
So right now, how many people have you had use the site?
So we have now about 1,000 users and 1,000 visitors in the last 30 days and about 100 users on our website.
And is the idea right now that it's mostly for the Springfield area, or is there something you'd like to extend throughout the rest of Illinois?
So we would like to extend to rest of the Illinois. We have doctors from Illinois in our web portal right now, and we are going to expand to all of U.S. Doctors next week.
So it sounds like it's going to be, we're going through an expansion at the beginning stages of HealthSoul.com. Dr. Ish Singla is an interventional cardiologist. He's at the Springfield Clinic. He's also co-creator of HealthSoul.com along with his wife. Dr. Singla, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21stshow. That's our handle. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on the air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. If you search for us on Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.